Welcome to Teaching Restored, where we are your weekly teacher council meeting. We get to help teach all about how to teach the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. We love teaching, we teach as much as we can, whether it be our family or friends or callings or family. Boy, there's a lot of family that we teach, don't we?
Our family.
Yeah.
Glad you brought up family, Kevin.
What was that?
Said, glad you brought up family.
Family. Speaking of family, Julie, Before we get into that. A recent episode, we talked about the difference between accountability and responsibility. Tell me, now that we've had some time to let that percolate, what did you learn from that? What were your major takeaways?
Oh, okay. So it's so interesting that you asked me that, because I was just trying to articulate this to somebody in a succinct 2-minute video. And I got stuck on something. So I would like a reminder, but the biggest thing that stuck out to me and the thing that's been really, really resonating with me is the definition of accountability as being the person that's accountable is the person that the consequences will impact the most. And that we have to be really careful that in the way that we interact with that person, that we are not in some way, and I can't remember the word that we used,
but like
subsume, that was it. I was trying to say usurp or just basically take that accountability on, and the consequences of doing that, both for the other person and for ourselves. So those parts of that podcast, which that was a very big point of it that I explained very badly, but that part of that episode was really impactful to me.
Good. Yeah, it's interesting with the subsumption of accountability. It is not actually a thing. It's something that it seems like we can subsume someone's accountability, but it's just a facade. We actually can't do that. It will wind up coming back to them no matter what, period.
Right. Well, and that's what I was struggling to kind of articulate, is the fact that we attempt to subsume it, but the consequence of that is that it hurts us and it actually ends up hurting them. Like, we're setting them up for failure if we don't allow accountability to reside where it belongs.
Right.
Because the buck is still going to stop there. Like, the consequences are still going to hurt them the most. You don't subsume the consequences with the accountability necessarily, because you can't.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're spot on. So yeah, as a teacher, as a teacher then, we can try to subsume their accountability for learning. And again, it's not a real thing, but we can think that we take it on ourselves, and yet we actually don't.
Okay.
Right? And that in the long run hurts them. Because the other side of the subsumption of accountability is that not only do we take it on, but the other person feels like, oh, it's not on me anymore.
Right.
Right.
You mean they feel less of it? Like, they feel like, so for example, like with our kids or whatever, if we try to subsume accountability, they might be like, oh, phew, mom's got this.
Yeah.
Kind of like that, right? That's a little bit of, okay.
Exactly. So if we do that in a teaching aspect, it's the person who is supposedly learning can think, you know what? I didn't learn anything today. And that's the teacher's fault.
Yeah.
That's the church's fault.
Yes.
No. You think it's actually your fault. And then they can put the blame on whomever they want to, but it not them.
Right. Like, I came to church to be fed, and I like, right. I there was a conference talk that was given about that, and I'm really bad at remembering who gives talks and stuff like that, but they talked about how we have a tendency like that as members of the church. We're like, we come to church and we expect people to connect with us, and we expect to be fed, and we expect to, and how interesting that is.
Yes. And that all has to do with accountability and responsibility. I mean, if you trace it back, it goes right directly back to that principle.
Do you think that there is a little bit of something in the, like, maybe I don't want to like blame the culture of the church, because I feel like that can be a little bit of a cop out sometimes, but that teachers naturally, like teachers of the gospel, Sunday school teachers, et cetera, naturally have a tendency to subsume that? Like, is that why are we almost trained to expect to be fed?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I 100% think that.
Okay.
100%. And and I don't want to say it shouldn't be, because we should all learn how to learn ourselves. And intuitively, we know that. We know that if I don't take charge of my learning, it may or may not happen. Well, it right. won't happen. But right. at the same time, with the culture, and I'm with you, I don't want to put blame on the culture of the church, because, yeah, I agree, it can be a cop-out sometimes. But if we just look at the culture of the church, we do train ourselves into it. But at the same time, it's bigger than that. It is so much bigger than that. You take government, you take local cultures, you can expand it out as wide as you want. And all of those principles are there as well. And you can see it one after the other, after the other, whether it's your neighbors that you're talking with, or a school district, or the church, or your state, or the federal government, it's all the same. There are people who actively actually try to subsume others' accountability, and they make them, the people who have the accountability, think that they don't need to worry about it. And so they take it on themselves, and who's the hero or who's not the hero, when in the end, it was never about that other person. It was always about that one who will get the consequence, good or bad.
Right, right, right. So that's an interesting thought, because I think about in 7 habits, habit one is to be proactive. And that is not just about taking initiative. It's also about taking ownership. And historically, I've called it taking responsibility. But I think that part of it is actually embracing accountability instead of trying to, what is it when you subsume it if you're receiving it? What is it? Do you circumsume it or something? If you're trying to, like, what is it that if you like want to hand it off to someone?
You allow someone else to subsume it.
You allow someone else. But that's a long sentence.
One word.
Like, I wanted one word. But you, yeah, I think that we have a tendency.
I was going to say
delegate. Yeah,
we got to come up with a good word for that.
We will. But I was thinking like circumventing, responsibility was kind of, so I was like circumsuming, but it doesn't work. It's not right. But I think that we do that. And I think that that's actually one of the things that's been really interesting for me, just an observation, with kids and raising teenagers and stuff like that, that there is something in our culture, and you kind of specified across different parts of, our culture, politics, education, communities, et cetera, that there is kind of this lack of holding people accountable, which creates almost in response, people not feeling the need to hold themselves accountable.
Right. Yes.
That's what you're describing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. So if we take that then and take it into the classroom, into the church classroom where we are teaching, or even with our kids, or even with our neighbors, with whom we are trying to share the gospel. And we have this culture that the student, we'll just call it teacher-student relationship right now, but the student is supposed to be there and is supposed to learn from the teacher, and the teacher expounds and exhorts and gives the information. And if they do a horrible job, then the person learning doesn't get learned up like they should. Right? Then what we do is place undue pressure on the teacher, saying, you need to be the best teacher ever, or your students will not learn.
And wrongzo.
And what?
I said wrongzo. And yeah, wrongzo. You were saying that's a load of malarkey.
That's a lot of pressure for the teacher to get it right. And that's why new people come in to the church, they are baptized, and then there you go, you need to teach. And it's, I don't know this stuff. How am I supposed to teach it? And
see, I don't know.
And they just get really nervous and they back out. And I've seen a number of people do that. But I've seen other people do the exact opposite. So go ahead and say what you're going to say before I move on.
Yeah, I don't want to hijack, but it's really interesting. I had this conversation this morning. I think we might have like a tiny little delay today because I keep almost talking over you. It's kind of weird. I'm so sorry about that.
No worries.
So I had this experience today. And so I've been thinking about this, but I didn't know we were going to talk about this. So I didn't know that I needed to be thinking about this. But I have a friend who's going through something really difficult right now. And she is not, she's a woman of faith, but not religion. And she was raised religious, but is no longer practicing any religion, but she definitely is spiritual and intuitive and recognizes the need to connect with the divine. And we were having a conversation about this difficult thing that she was going through. And I, in the course of our discussion, just asked her, you know, about her faith community and ended up inviting her to come to church. And she wrote me back today and said, I'd love to take you up on that. And I said, you know, anytime, that would be wonderful. And then I related something to her, and I didn't know why I felt the need to relate this to her. But I said, you know, one of the things about our church that's a little bit different is, you know, you'll come to this main meeting and it's the members of the church that will give the sermon, not a preacher. And I realized something as I was writing this, and I actually articulated this to her. I said, you know, it makes for a really authentic experience. And that's one of the things that I actually appreciate about it. And so as you're talking about all of this, and you're talking about kind of the pressure that gets put on the teacher, because the teacher in a way feels the need to subsume accountability for everybody's learning. Well, same goes when you're giving a talk in church. It's almost like you feel the weight of the pressure, like you are somehow accountable for people getting something out of it.
Right.
And so as I was relating this to her, and it started off as me making an excuse that she might not get as much out of it as she would if there was this big polished sermon. But then I realized as I was writing it, that I actually think it lends to more authentic kind of, it's not dialogue, but more authentic instruction, if you will. And so anyway, I know that that was a tiny bit of a tangent, but it was something that I actually started to think about that I appreciate about the way. And I do think that the church is making an effort to take away that desire or instinct to subsume responsibility by the way that they're teaching us to teach. Like, teaching in the Savior's way gives us instruction that is different from what we're describing with this subsuming of the accountability for everybody's learning, right?
Yeah, I am on board with you 100%. I've been to other churches and have seen someone get up, and it's a pastor that always gets up. And I wonder how much of a culture they have of the pastor teaches, we learn. I mean, I've heard of others saying, you know, our pastor got up and it wasn't that great. I mean, it was okay. He's kind of said the same thing before, so I really didn't learn anything. And so I kind of get the hint that it's the same thing, that the pastor takes on that. But when it is us doing it, when it's the lay members of the church, we have to kind of learn ourselves so that we can help instruct in what we've learned. And it does become more authentic, I think. It's not just, this is how everything should be and this is the way it is, but it's individual members saying, this is what's happened to me. This is what I've learned. This is what I believe. And we get a sense of kind of community in that way, I think, which I love.
I do too. It was interesting though. I don't think that I've ever thought about it that hard.
That is pretty neat though. Yeah.
As I was trying to kind of articulate it in this text to her a little bit earlier.
That's good. So if we are teaching and all of a sudden we realize we're not accountable for their learning, then what are we doing? Why are we there? What are we doing? Do you have any thoughts right off the bat about that?
Yeah, I'll tell you what popped into my head. I think, and I don't know if this is the direction you're intending for it to go on or to go in, but I think we're like sparking thoughts in each other. Like part of it is just this, okay. So in Crucial Conversations, they define dialogue as the free flow of meaning among two or more people, right?
Okay.
And they describe that in dialogue, the idea is that you're adding to a shared pool of meaning. And I think that's literally what class is intended to be, because you're thinking, if you have your own individual pool, this is what it means to you. And that's it. Like, you think you're right and everything, this is your truth, whatever. But when you have a shared pool of other people's, not just information and knowledge, but what it means to them, their meaning, and that shared pool meaning, then everybody's understanding rises. Mm-hmm. It changes together. It becomes more informed. It expands. And so I kind of view it that way, that our job is to create a shared pool of meaning in a learning space. And so part of our responsibility isn't necessarily to give the information, but to create a space where it's safe for other people to share their meaning.
I love that. Yes. Okay, then let me follow up with this question. Understanding that as a teacher, how do you know if you're successful?
Honestly, and I'm going to say this and then I'm going to refute myself, but I think it's when people share. Like when the conversation, the dialogue becomes meaningful, like people are sharing meaning, like meaningful, F-U-L-L,
mm-hmm.
full of meaning, versus when people are giving Sunday school answers, and because that is an indication that maybe they don't feel safe to share what's really in here. So that's how I would define it. And then the only reason that I would refute myself is that I think that sometimes it can turn into a bit of a runaway freight train. And so you do have to be careful that you're also doing a little bit of management. And we've talked about that before, because I think you have both ends of the spectrum. You have crickets in some classes and you have oversharers in others, and you have to kind of be able to manage depending on the dynamic of the class. But I really do think that success is defined as people sharing.
Okay.
I don't know.
I like that. Let me throw a little wrench possibly into that. Okay. Maybe. I don't know. What if we're missionaries and we are teaching someone who doesn't know anything about the church and this is all brand new to them? And we're teaching, okay, here are the facts. Here is how Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ, how they play into our lives, and they don't understand that. And you're talking about commandments. It would seem like it's a lot of information that you're giving to them. Is there that shared pool of meaning in those times?
Okay.
So for those of you who can't see, she's getting really giddy and jumping up and
down. Yes. I kind of like, okay. So I got asked to go and speak to the missionaries again in January at their zone conferences.
Oh, how fun.
So I know, I love it so much. It's one of my favorite things to do. And it's talking again about questions, but in my opinion, and this is, we've talked about this before, that I think we get so hung up on either answering people's questions or on giving them information and do you have any questions, or asking them questions and expecting a certain answer so that we can build on it, that we forget to actually empathically listen to their responses. Mm-hmm. And what you are doing through an empathic conversation is creating a shared pool of meaning. And so you are going to add meaning to it in the form of not just the information about the gospel of Jesus Christ, but in the form of what it actually means to you. That's the goal. If you are being an effective missionary, I suspect that you are bringing your life experience to that conversation. And then you're not going to stop there. You're going to be like, tell us your thoughts. Tell us your feelings. I'm going to ask an introspective question. And then you're going to empathically listen to that response, because your understanding is going to increase, grow, expand based on what they're sharing. And I think, like, if we as missionaries think that we have stuff to share and it stops there, then we are mistaken about our role as a missionary. Our role as a missionary is to connect with other people and help through that all of us connect more on a deeper level to Jesus Christ. But don't forget that that's a shared pool, not a my pool in your pool. It's a shared pool.
Good. Good. I think a lot of people see teaching as there's my pool, there's your pool, and these are different things. And it, even there may be, I think, a sense of we're going to share, quote, in air quotes, share. You give yours. I gave mine, and we all just share a little bit. But actually, I think what you're talking about is a sharing on a deeper level. It's not just here's my experience. Here's my experience. Okay, that's nice. And then anyone else? Okay, da-da-da-da. And we go on. Okay, here's the story, right? It's like we're invested in it, in this pool.
Yes. Right? Yeah, okay. So think about this. Get a little molecular for a second.
Oh.
If we describe it as a pool, what is a pool normally filled with?
Many things.
Mainly.
I mean, if we're talking like a swimming pool, we're talking pool. H2O.
Yes, H2O. So can you keep your H2O separate from someone else's H2O once you dump it in the pool?
That's good.
Yeah, right? Like it all gets mixed in. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why I think that's a very intentional way that the authors, you know, created it, is to call it a shared pool, because it becomes everyone's, like there's this meshing of meaning. It's not just isolated, your meaning, my meaning.
And so in a way, the shared pool of meaning almost takes on a life of its own and becomes something more than the sum of its parts. It's a new thing in that point.
It's synergy. You're just describing synergy, yes, where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. I think what you honestly are describing, like if you think about this in a classroom setting, oh, Kevin, this is so cool. Like this is a fun little, okay, I'm getting all jazzed about it. So when you think about that type of, you know, meaning, your meaning, my meaning, all the meaning, getting molecularly mixed together, everybody's understanding changes, evolves, grows, expands as a result of it. That literally by definition is something that you could not do by yourself. And the sum of all of that is so much better than anything that any individual could create on their own. And I think that that's part of the beauty of what we're trying to create in a classroom. We're trying to have a synergistic experience together versus a transactional one.
That's good. But there are some inherent issues with that, Julie.
Uh-oh.
I mean, if I'm a teacher and I'm used to controlling the classroom, making sure people need to learn what they need to learn, that kind of ruins the whole game plan.
Except, Kevin, so yes, yes. But what if you plan for it?
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about planning for it to go awry.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So can I just tell you that this has been one of the biggest, like, learnings for me, if you will, in this past year? Because during COVID, I taught online, right? And so a lot of it was not nearly as interactive. And so I would prepare these lessons that would be pages long because I had 90 minutes with, you know, of a virtual class. And so people would react and answer questions and things like that. But most of it was me giving information. And I got used to that. I loved prepping for it. I loved digging in. I had something to share when I would come to these. People would, like, it was very validating, honestly, because they'd be like, oh my gosh, I got so much out of that, la, 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 la. So then when we came back together, I'd be like, well, I still have things to share, people. And I would get anxious about it. And I'd be like, oh my gosh, we only got through 1/4 of what I was, blah, blah, blah. And I used to get frustrated. And so because I'm a very linear thinker, I made myself half the notes that I would take to class. I'm like, okay, then just cut it in half. Just cut your expectations in half. And I did that and still wouldn't get through all of it. And so I finally was like, okay, what is my 1 point? And then I'm like, no, probably more than 1 point. What are my 2 points? And then I would give myself 2 points that I could make. And I honestly, I just had to scale back. And this is an exercise of finding simplicity on the far side of complexity when it comes to whatever lesson it is that you're going to teach, because then I knew that we would have, it was a choose your own adventure. I would call it that. I'm like, this is going to be a choose your own adventure today. And we would have that type of an experience, but you never let it get off track. That's the key. So you're talking about planning for it to go awry. You don't want it to go awry and you don't want it to get off track. And that's part of your job as a teacher, is to keep bringing it back, which is why you need to know what is the main point you're trying to make. Yeah. You've got to have that, so you have something to come back to.
Good. So I kind of see this whole thing as not by, a lot of times we want to play by the rules, whether they be cultural rules or the handbook rules, right? We do that. But I think what you're describing, I personally see as playing a whole different game, right? You're blowing the rules out of the water and you're saying, I'm not playing that game anymore. I'm going to play this other game. It's kind of like when I think of this concept, I go back to the iPhone. When before that we had phones, we had flip phones, and then Steve Jobs comes out with an iPhone and it's like, what is it? Right now, today we're like, yeah, duh. Back then it wasn't duh. It was,
yeah,
this completely changes the rules, the game, everything. This is, and everyone changed the game with it and started playing that game, right, instead of the game that they were playing and making millions of dollars on. Now they're going to complete. And it's, and I feel it's the same thing, right? For us to do what you're talking about, we need to change the game. It's not the same anymore.
No.
And I think that's what has been expected of us, that we should be changing the game, but we get stuck in this. In I am the deliverer of information, and I am here to entertain you and make this a fun experience, and et cetera, right?
So don't you think, I think what I hear you saying, and I want to make sure that I'm tracking right with you, but isn't this what is taught in Teaching the Savior's Way? Like that, yes, we are intended to be a facilitator, right? So why are we kicking and screaming against it so much? Like, why are we having such a difficult time making that shift, do you think?
We're used to it. And now, that's where, so this is where the culture comes into play. And one of the things that I have focused on in my career is culture. And it is amazing how potent the embedded culture can be. I mean, it will, you can have the best, coolest thing in the world, and if the culture doesn't accept it, it's gone. It won't be accepted.
Yeah, it's super, super powerful. So are you insinuating with that comment that maybe we as participants in a class don't accept that culturally? That we might be kicking against it?
No, I'm not saying that, I mean, that almost sounds like, I mean, to me, it almost sounds like an uprising from the students, right?
No, not that. Let me describe what I mean by that. Like, cause I can picture what you're saying, like that we have an expectation and it's almost like that expectation is part of what we need to get rid of as learners. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we,
that's true.
Culture, if it plays on both sides, like the teacher feels the weight of this responsibility, the learner's like, yeah, bring it, feed me, mm-hmm. then that's what the culture sustains. And the minute that you have a teacher who now comes in and is trying to facilitate this authentic discussion where you're creating this synergistic shared pool of meaning, you're going to be like, I thought I was just going to relax today.
Right.
I was ready to like and read a couple conference talks in the background.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's happening. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, are we kicking against it a little bit? Do we actually like hold back and not participate as much? And
yes.
Like, is it hard for us? Are we like having to kind of stretch and grow with it as well?
I think 100%. I think 100% we are doing that because it's easier. It's easier for someone to subsume that and to allow someone to subsume that, right? And just like you said, I'm just going to sit back and relax and just listen or read a couple of conference talks or whatever, let them kind of take over.
Yeah.
But it takes proactive energy to decide, I'm going to learn something today. I'm going to be open and I'm going to try to contribute to the shared pool of meaning in there. Even if the teacher may not try to create that, I may, you know, just try to do it myself and add to that.
So that you bring up something really interesting, like, because I have sat in a number of classes where I definitely don't feel that type of collaborative desire from the teacher. In fact, when I've made a comment, they've just moved right on, right? We've talked about that before, how important it is as teachers to really validate every person's comment. And so if they're doing that, what do you do? Like, how do you kick against that? Or do you just let it be what it is? Or
so I think there are some small things you can do. I don't know that there are some big things that you can do to change it all the way.
Right.
I don't want to go into all the small things that you can do because we could be here for a while and they may almost seem presumptive and like, oh, I'm better than,
or like you're hijacking the teacher.
Yeah. Like you're hijacking. Yeah. Yeah. And that's not the intent. Mm-mm. But I think that as we become teachers or as we have an opportunity to teach, that we remember our role and how we can help others to participate and share and how we can facilitate and that we do it right and set the example, probably more than anything.
Yeah, and I do agree with you. Let me just make one comment on the learner side. I do think that there is one simple thing we can do that, and I don't, we're not going to go into all of them, like you said. And that is just I've noticed that if I make a really genuine, authentic, humble, sincere comment, usually, you know, I'm stretched just a little bit in my heart to say it, that people follow up with like comments, meaning that once you like start the trend of Sunday school answers, people follow. But once you start a different type of conversation by modeling it yourself, people also follow.
That's good.
And so I do think that setting the example is one good way to do that.
Good. Okay. Now we started this conversation with, how do you know that you're a good teacher? How do you know, or that you've been successful? Let me throw out one thing that Preach My Gospel says about this.
Yeah.
And this is for missionaries, and missionaries do more than teach. There's a lot that missionaries do beyond just teaching. So this is not a one-to-one ratio of, you know, a teacher or even a parent should do this 100% or feel this way 100%. But I think that there's a good lesson for us to learn. It's on page 13 under it's a success. The sub headline is a success. A successful missionary.
Do you know which chapter it's in? Cause I don't have page numbers on my phone.
Yeah. Let me see. It's under your purpose. So I guess chapter one under your purpose and almost all the way to the end. A successful missionary. It says, your success as a missionary is determined primarily by desire and commitment to, and then they say, to find, teach, baptize, and confirm converts to help become more faithful or help them become faithful disciples of Jesus Christ and members of his church. But really what it is there is your success is determined by your desire and commitment. on a fundamental level, whether we baptize as a missionary, whether we baptize a bazillion people or not, that does not determine whether we've been successful. What really determines if we've been successful is our desire and our commitment, right?
I love that. It's interesting because it literally does go through and say, it is not determined by how many people you teach
right.
or bring to baptism. It is not dependent on whether or how others respond to you. Like, I love that.
Now, riff that into teaching.
Okay. So really, truly, yeah, and I can I riff it into what we've just been talking
yes.
about as well? So your success as a teacher is determined primarily by your desire and commitment. And I think that if you have a desire to create an environment where people can add to a shared pool of meaning, then you're going to nail it. Even if the conversation doesn't always flow perfectly, and even if, you know, you have people at first seem like they're just kind of chilling in the background waiting to be fed, your desire to make that happen and determination to create that type of a space invites the spirit to it. And that's what will determine your success.
Have you ever seen someone in a, let's say, a basketball game who is not very good, but their heart is so in it?
Yeah.
Right? Yesterday we went to our youngest son's first basketball game of the season, and they played on a floor that I swear they poured on. It was not wood. It was not, I don't know what it was. It was like rubber or something, but they must have just poured it on. And it was an old school. And the years of layer of dust that had settled on that, the kids were slipping everywhere.
Oh,
they
awful.
Couldn't like cut or anything because they would just go and slip and slide. I mean, it was like they were ice skating. It was crazy. And some of them just kind of gave up and were like, okay, I'm not going to do much. But some of them were just so into it, and they couldn't be good even if they tried, right? They were just, but they were awesome. Sliding. They would stop and skid and keep going. And it was hilarious.
Oh my gosh, I love it.
It was so good. But I feel like that, in a way, there are many people out there who may be listening who may feel, I don't know how to create that. They may think, I am so in this, I need to teach the people. I have no idea how to do that. And what I just heard you say is, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Your desire and commitment to doing that is really what matters. So we can look at someone on the basketball court who's trying, not very good, and we can say, you know what, doesn't matter. Their heart is of gold and they are rocking it, right? Even if they didn't score any baskets. Same thing with a teacher, I think. I think if we are trying that and our desire and our commitment is there to do that, then we're going to be successful. That is what makes it successful. Not the baptisms, not that everyone comes out going, oh my goodness, that was the best class ever. Yeah, that's not it. Desire and commitment.
Yeah, and that's hard. That's hard to get your headspace as a teacher into a place where you redefine your own success. It takes a lot of humility.
Yes. Okay. How about this one? What if other people are labeling how good you did as a teacher on how, let's say this. As a missionary, what if you came home and you didn't baptize anyone and people judged you for that? Said, oh, you didn't baptize anyone. You weren't very successful for that, right? Turn that around to teacher perspective. Yeah, you didn't do that. You're not a very successful teacher because, you know, you didn't read the scriptures enough or whatever it may be. I think we have to realize that they are not the one who's deciding whether we're successful or not. If we're talking about desire and commitment, that's God, not other people's comments.
Absolutely.
So keep teaching, keep helping to create the shared pool of meaning, help keep understanding and trying to learn how to help people open up and share, really share. Mm-hmm. Like you said, in the pool, you spill the water in What part is your water? I don't know. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I love that analogy. That's so good.
Yeah. Pour your heart into it.
Yeah. So those are my initial thoughts after we had that discussion around accountability and responsibility. I want to make sure that as we are teaching that it's not so much, so many people are saying, okay, well, can I be successful? Am I successful at all? Let's redefine what success is. Let's make sure that we understand what we're really trying to go for. And as long as we're really, really trying, I think that's really what matters in the end. So, all right. Thank you, Julie. I appreciate
that. Thank you.
Good, great thoughts. If you would, please share, subscribe, like, leave us a comment below and help others realize that that is really what matters, that their commitment is there, that their desire is there, and they're going to be a great teacher. Thanks for listening, everyone. Take care.
Bye.